Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
My guests tonight are two eminent urban sociologists. You may think you know what sociology is. What happens when you apply sociology to the urban scene? We shall discover as we talk with Robert Sampson and Philip Niden. Robert Sampson is a professor in the sociology department at Harvard University. In fact, he came there from the University of Chicago. He's the author of a new book titled Great American City, Chicago and the Enduring Neighborhood Effect. There's a second question. What exactly is the neighborhood effect? We will shortly discover. Our other guest is Philip Niden, who is professor of sociology at Loyola University, where he's the director of the Center for Urban Research and Learning. And he's been doing a great deal of research on Chicago, as has Robert Sampson. Robert Sampson, there's an old tradition that urban sociology more or less begins at the University of Chicago. Not during the years when you professed in that department, but way back in the first two decades of the 20th century. Was it Park or was it Burgess or one of their colleagues who got off this line? I worked from memory, couldn't find it in a quotations roster, but I'm sure that basically this was it. Chicago, he, whoever he was, said, Chicago is a fur-lined garbage can. Do you recognize that?
I don't know if I've heard that one before. I've heard the one about peeling the intestines, skin back, and you can see the intestines. The idea that Chicago, particularly at the time, was very raw and served as an urban laboratory. Indeed, the early Chicago School of Sociology, they took to the streets and really saw it as a way to understand everything that was happening in American society.
I mentioned Park and Burgess. They were two of the leaders of that group.
Absolutely.
There were some 10 others you could identify.
Yeah, Park and Burgess are well known. They wrote a classic book, The City, and they sent their students out into Chicago. But there were many others.
What is the American sociological approach to the study of the city? Indeed, what are the actual lines and traditions in urban sociology? I put that question directly to Philip Niden.
I mean, certainly when we talk about the Chicago School of Urban Sociology, it's getting out there in the community, and it's actually seeing things, not necessarily writing from your chair in the office, but actually getting out and looking at communities, talking to immigrants, talking to folks that may be in gangs, talking to community leaders, talking to political bosses, talking to the rank and file, talking to union members.
And when sociologists did a lot of that talking to active participants in the culture of the city of Chicago, what generalizations began to form up? What did they begin to learn that might have been of some surprise or at least of some startling veridicality?
Well, a lot of the early research in Chicago, they tended to focus in on particular communities. So there were many classic studies that would focus in on, let's say, an immigrant community. One of the most famous works was the Polish peasant
Florian
in America.
Zaniecki.
Thomas and Zaniecki, right?
Where did they work?
Thomas was at the University of Chicago.
Of Chicago. Yeah. Zaniecki was?
He was fired. By the University of Chicago at some
really?
Point for, yeah.
Zaniecki's daughter, many years later, worked, I think, at Loyola.
Taught at Loyola. It was a colleague of mine for years.
Yeah, I've met her once.
But it was all about immigrant adjustment and moving from the rural areas of Poland and how you the family adjusted in the big city. And it was a really classic study. And it was really about the social organization of the city. But there were studies of hobos, Nels Anderson. There were studies of the Gold Coast, even back then. In fact, one of the most famous books we could also point to was The Gold Coast and the Slum. That was by Henry Zorbaugh, published in 1929. Still relevant in many ways.
Wasn't there somebody at the University of Chicago who did a study of, dance halls?
Dance hall, taxi dance hall.
Dance hall, taxi dancing, where you pay 10 cents for a ticket to have a dance and so on. And, of course, there was major study of black life in Chicago.
Yes, black metropolis is well known. Drake and Caton really stands the test of time, I think, in terms of the depth with which they studied that particular community. It's a very thick book, and if you go back to it, reissued relatively recently, still has a lot to tell us about the differentiation within the black community and the tensions both within the community and between the black community and the white community. That was published, that was around 1945, but they also drew on the University of Chicago sure. School quite heavily.
Now, urban sociology has been practiced for a long time. It may really have begun at the University of Chicago as a systematic mode of inquiry back in the first and second decades of the 20th century. Overall, what now is our understanding of life in the great urban center? What has sociology contributed to that otherwise we would not have known?
Well, what's happened, and I think Dr. Sampson points this out in his book, is that there's lots. It's been dissected many ways. In some ways, it's we look at crime, we look at issues of development, look at poverty, look at schools. I mean, we look at these various categories, and I think one issue is that is not always put back together again. People don't live lives according to the disciplines of academia. It's they don't live a psychological life, a sociological life, an economic life. We live that every minute, every day, all together. And I think one approach to examining communities is to put it all together and look at how communities affect our lives.
And when you ask that question, how communities affect our lives, what kinds of answers begin to emerge?
Well, overall, I argue in the book that place and neighborhoods, the areas of the cities in which we live, have a great power to affect our lives. And also, the city is organized by neighborhoods. And so I really try to look at the diversity of phenomena, as Professor Nyden just noted. Things go together. We tend to split things apart. And in fact, the way academia and even, let's say, medicine, if you look at the National Institutes of Health, everything is divided up and things are studied separately. But in fact, many things go together. And what I show is that any number of phenomena, whether it's crime, whether it's poverty, whether it's teenage pregnancy, foreclosures, altruism, any number of things tend to cluster together in particular neighborhoods. And secondly, there's a surprising persistence over time in the general social character of neighborhoods. And I think when you take into
neighborhoods
account—
Neighborhoods don't really change, is what you're saying.
Well, it's a specific kind of change. Neighborhoods are always changing. Think of it as a paradox. People move in, people move out. They're dynamic entities. But the position and the character of those neighborhoods does not necessarily change. So you can have an increase in income, let's say, in all neighborhoods or increases in poverty, but yet they don't shift position. One way perhaps to understand this is to think about a pecking order, that mm-hmm. the status and the arrangement of neighborhoods is quite stable. I mean, sure, some neighborhoods do better over time and others sort of fall off the map, but in general— as I noted, the Gold Coast and the slum, 1929, the Gold Coast is still the Gold Coast.
People's opinions of the neighborhoods remain rather constant, even as the neighborhoods undergo some inevitable patterns of change.
Yes, and that's part of the reason for that. Yeah. The perceptions and the status and the reputations are reproduced over time.
Well, we have yet another instance of the wisdom of the great French maxim, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more it changes, the more it remains the same thing. We'll look. I can't resist asking. I ask now, even as we're about to pause for some commercials. You lived for some time, I presume, when you were a University of Chicago professor in Hyde Park.
I actually live far south.
Away
equivalent
from
about 183rd and Western.
Ah, well. I lived for some years in Hyde Park. And if neighborhoods change the people who move into them, I wonder if that applies even in university neighborhoods.
Hyde Park's a very interesting community to talk about.
I want to hear more about it right after we hear about this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Philip Nyden and Robert Sampson as we apply urban sociology to an analysis of the Chicago scene and Chicago neighborhoods and Chicago problems, of which there are plenty still abiding, despite the fact that we've been gifted with a mayor chosen for us by the President of the United States. You were about to say, Robert, that there is something quite distinctive about Hyde Park. Distinctive or typical of, say, of neighborhoods in which a great university is lodged in the middle?
Well, I wouldn't say it's too typical. I mean, it's changed over the years in terms of the relationship between the university and the community. If you go back into, let's say, the mid-20th century, I think the university was then even more of a kind of a fortress and insular in terms of its surroundings.
It felt threatened.
It felt threatened. In fact, many people don't know this, but it almost moved out of the city because of its the perception that crime and the inroads from the concentration of disadvantage around it were too much to overcome.
They were considering two separate moving plans. One was out into the suburbs, someplace around Chicago. The other was to merge, was it with Stanford or with...
Yeah, it was some bizarre...
To move to California.
Yeah, thank God they didn't. Although they did, you know, rip up a lot of the, you know, jazz and so forth on north of the community. So along 47th and streets like that, it changed quite a bit. The community survived, and it did much better. It's a thriving, stable, integrated community. Again, people are moving in, people are moving out. It's a dynamic community, but yet it's retained its rich cultural character. It's very organizationally dense. One of the reasons I think that it's able to maintain the sort of diversity it has over time is because of the presence of the University of Chicago. Having an institution like that be carefully involved in the community is essentially important. And not every community has that kind of rich institutional infrastructure to support efforts at integration.
Another large university right in the middle of Chicago, a different part of Chicago, is Loyola.
Sure.
Of course, it's got two different campuses.
Three, actually.
Three?
Maywood.
Yeah.
As well.
Maywood,
that's
yes. I've never been there. But what's it's Town and Gown we're talking about.
Sure.
But Gown is very towny for a place like Loyola. What's the interaction like there?
We've done a lot of work nationally on what produces stable, racially, ethnically diverse communities. Mm-hmm. And actually, Rogers Park, Edgewater, Uptown are probably three of the most stably diverse communities in the nation.
That is your special research interest, isn't it?
We've done a lot of work. We've worked with HUD, and we're doing some follow-up now. Mm-hmm. Universities often are at the center of some of those, not all. And it's also strong community-based organizations that have as their work to produce that kind of diversity and also to maintain it are really critical. I think that community voice, that community energy, community resources.
I want you to hear something that we've got on a recording. This would be, apparently it's not ready yet. Is that what you're telling me in the booth? You'll hear it a little bit later on. But Bill Simpson, a good friend of ours, has been often on this program. He's a former member of the city council, and is, of course, the chairman of political science at UIC. And he just recently released some data, a heavy study that he and his colleagues have done up, on corruption in Chicago government. Indeed, he's done a larger study on corruption in the government of Illinois. But we've got some interesting stuff about Chicago as such. I gather it's not quite ready yet, but it will be before too long, I trust. But all the same, let's turn to that right now. What's utterly dysfunctional in major American cities, or they are more and more dysfunctional if they are more and more burdened by crime. And they're even more disheartening if they're burdened by crime on the part of those who are supposed to do the governing. What do we know about the degree to which corruption and crime burden American cities? Is there considerable variation in that? Is it true that Minneapolis is a pristine garden of civic virtue compared, say, to Chicago?
Well, I don't know if any city is pristine, but certainly Chicago has a reputation over the years for being rather corrupt. Illinois has kind of set the national tone recently at the state level, but
half of our governors go to
prison. Yeah, unfortunately. I'm not sure. I mean, it's been written about a lot, and we don't have really good data at a comparative level. That is to say, you know, how does Chicago look compared to New York, compared to Boston? I think the common understanding is that it was more corrupt, depending on how we define corruption. Of course, it was also known as the city that works, and in fact, some would argue that one of the ways it worked was through corruption, sort of a quid pro quo, and that citizens in part were complicit in that. So Milton, it's more complex, I think.
Milton Rakove, who was a great student of the Chicago political machine and did two or three major books on that. A University of Chicago PhD, one of Hans Morgenthau's PhDs, who then went to UIC, where he had his full career, did the book, the famous book, Don't Make No Waves, Don't Back No Losers, and then We Don't Want Nobody. Nobody said it.
That's right.
But they're both examinations of political corruption and its functionality, its value in the city of Chicago.
Yeah,
and the machine was quite corrupt, and it served the city well through corruption.
Yeah, and I think in a way residents came to expect that. The downside, though, is it leads to a certain sense of a cynicism about government. And one thing that we found in our study is that sense of cynicism about the legitimacy of institutions, particularly criminal justice institutions, can really wreak havoc, particularly in communities that are severely disadvantaged, where there's a lot of hostility or perhaps lack of trust between residents and the police. And if you overlay that with corruption, then that's a powder keg.
Well, there we come to the central and persisting fact about something profoundly dysfunctional in Chicago, namely the sense within the inner city black community, by which one means the ghetto, by which one means those blacks who've not got out into middle-class life and middle-class education, but those who are left behind, who feel heavily misused by police and more broadly by the city, to the extent that they're aware of what's going on, because there's also considerable educational deficit and general sinking of a sense of the nature of the civic contract, let alone the achievement of civic virtue. But the ordinary inner city blacks of Chicago and those who serve them and represent them and very often broadcast to them or represent them in Congress trade on that all the time as their basic complaint. And that hasn't changed. I've been living in the city since 1965. It was full of black bitterness against the governing institutions. It is still full of black bitterness against the governing institutions, even with some significant transformation in the presence of people of black African American origin in the larger categories of governance. That is a persisting problem, is it not?
I mean, I think thinking about some of this, I think it's also looking at the dynamic between community and elected officials. This is the city of Saul Alinsky. This is the city of Jane Addams. And there's a long history of community organizing often to put pressure on those elected officials and make them more honest or at least accountable. Honesty might be
and
a bigger
issue.
Has
it succeeded in that?
To some extent, I think in many ways, when you look at communities, what we see in communities are the current social interactions, the social situations are effectively truce lines between various competing forces. So you may have elected officials that may not be responsive, but you get a strong organization pushing them. They do make gains.
The view in the old days, of course, was that plantation politics obtained and that the original Daley had created a great system in which you gave rewards to black leaders and gave their communities a certain amount of payoff to keep them restive, rather to keep them unrestive, to keep them quiet and out of the way and down on the plantation, thus plantation politics. That's no longer the case?
Well, I mean, the city certainly certainly experienced a change with Harold Washington's election, even though there may have been a brief period that also punctuated the difference between Richard J. Daley and Richard M. Daley.
I'm very glad you mentioned it because we're about to pause for an update on the news. And when we return, let's hear Harold Washington on this program many years ago. But right now, to the WGN Newsroom and David Jennings.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
Our guests tonight, as I did tell you earlier, are two leading American urban sociologists. Philip Nyden is professor of sociology and director of the Center for Urban Research and Learning at Loyola University. And Robert Sampson, to give the full title, is the Henry Ford II Professor of the Social Sciences and Director of the Social Sciences Program at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study in the Department of Sociology at Harvard University. Pant, pant. He is, as well, the author of a very important new book titled Great American City, Chicago and the Enduring Neighborhood Effect. We've only hinted so far at what the neighborhood effect is. We'll come to it in fuller detail shortly. But first, here's what another former University of Chicago professor, now also indeed professor of sociology at Harvard University, has to say about this book. This is William Julius Wilson, who was often a member of, rather a guest on this program before he went to Cambridge, Massachusetts. and he says, Robert Sampson's great American city, Chicago, and the enduring neighborhood effect will not only change the way we think about neighborhood effects, it also sets a new standard for social scientific inquiry. Indeed, in my judgment, Great American City is one of the most comprehensive and sophisticated empirical studies ever conducted by a social scientist. The scope of this very readable and precisely worded book boggles the mind. It didn't quite boggle my mind, but it took up a few days of my time.
Well, good for you.
And it turned out to be quite profitable. And indeed, it's good reading, which is a rare compliment to a sociologist, I would say.
Thank you, I think.
Now, some years ago, another very loquacious fellow came on this radio program during the first year I did it, which is way back in 1974, I fear. And he was then a member of the state legislature. He went on eventually to go to Congress, and then he wound up mayor of Chicago. Here is Harold Washington on this program.
What we've got to do in terms of this city is come into the modern world. We need modern management tools in our city government. We're trying to institute that. We're trying to balance the interest between the downtown legitimate business people who want to grow in a market and the neighborhood people where 80% of the jobs are, who want their neighborhoods improved, want city services, want their schools improved, and want crime abated so they can move from door to door without fear of their lives. This is what people want, and you can't get those things unless you have a government which is relatively free of corruption and where inside dopesters don't take the cream off every day and do what they wish with it. These things have to be done. As compared to other cities, when we came into office, Chicago, unfortunately, was poorly, poorly managed. Everyone knew that. It was a thing. The press beat it about. The press had been in the forefront for reform for years, and all at once they lost the meaning of reform when I was elected on a reform program, and instead of supporting our quest from reform, we get this constant little nitpicking, oversimplification of serious, long-standing issues. We don't get the analysis, the extended analysis in the press that we are entitled to.
And since he talks about corruption and the burden of corruption, when he had come in as mayor, that was done only a few months after he took office as mayor of Chicago. As I mentioned earlier, Dick Simpson, our colleague, former member of the city council, chairman of political science at UIC, just did a major study on corruption in Chicago. He does present a number of quantitative findings. One of them, which really has stood out, and the press was much taken with this finding, is that one-third of all members of the Chicago City Council from 1965 to the present moment have gone to prison for corruption that the feds caught them on. Here is more, just another very brief excerpt of Dick Simpson on this program within the last month or two. Who are some of the most recent members of the council who have gone to prison? I know there's another one who's now up on charges and quite likely may shortly be going to prison, namely Alderman Beavers.
Yes, Alderman and now Commissioner Beavers is indicted. The last one convicted, there are two that are interesting. One of the most famous is Alderman Berdoliak.
To be sure.
And he's still in a halfway house, just getting released from his prison sentence.
Fast Eddie Berdoliak.
The other one, which is totally fascinating, could only happen in a place like Chicago, is Alderman Carruthers. The reason that's so interesting is his father, Alderman Carruthers, 20 years earlier had taken bribes from a developer and had gone to prison. And later, the new Alderman Carruthers, the son, took bribes from another developer and has gone to prison. And you know, you would think that in a family you would learn at least how to handle bribes better.
I want to add to that, gentlemen. I'm taking up a lot of time, but I must add something else and put it before you, then I want you to really respond to it. And it's this, that the kind of corruption you get in the city council is small peanuts. They take a bribe for $10,000 or $20,000. A few of them have real estate connections or other connections, and they can do more by the way they direct contracts to their own nephews or what have you. But the real corruption is probably what they call pinstripe corruption, which is not totally illegal, but in which those in City Hall are have been complicit and may or may not now be complicit, depending upon how the new administration performs, but was complicit during the run of the Dailies and Balandic and Jane Byrne. And that is sending contracts in the direction of people who make heavy contributions to you or otherwise get money back to you one way or another. All and they very often carry the contracts out, their road building, their other buildings, carry the contracts out with poor performance, with poor materials, producing sinkholes and potholes much sooner than the roads have to develop, producing buildings that might collapse or function very badly. In many ways, there's a relation between city government and bigger business, bigger corporate undertakings, contractors, surely, which in essence puts a very heavy corruption tax upon the citizens of Chicago. The less we get for our buck with regard to city contracts, the more we pay in terms of further taxes. We had with the last Daily and even with the new mayor, we have a continued assault upon, say, the ordinary Chicago driver to try to maximize the chances that he will get caught in some kind of speeding event or some kind of turning too quickly around on a legitimate U-turn with a red light, a legitimate right turn with a red light, and the camera catches him, and you fine him. Not $50, you fine him $100, $200. It's all a way of fleecing the poor citizen to help pay the corruption tax. I say that's dreadfully dysfunctional about Chicago, probably more so than most, if not all, other American cities. Am I wrong?
Well, I don't know. It's a pretty strong charge.
It is.
As I said, I don't know that we really have the data to say Chicago is more corrupt than other cities. Again, I think that's a common perception. And clearly, one could argue there's been a culture of corruption over time. I guess I'm not as negative in terms of thinking about the trajectory of the city, that is how it's evolved over time. And if you think about Chicago, and if it had this level of corruption, and let's assume that it's true, if you look, though, at how it's changed, particularly since the days when cities were really thought to be dying, and you remember in the 70s, the famous headline, 14 New York City dropped dead. If you go back to, let's say late 60s, mid 70s, Chicago, Cleveland, Detroit, they all looked very similar. Cities were thought to be dying, but yet Chicago was one of the most successful cities in the United States. It went up. It did better. It's actually quite a remarkable city, I would argue, in terms of how it functions and its overall health and well-being, relatively speaking. It didn't go the way of Detroit. It didn't go the way of Cleveland. If you really want to do a comparative analysis. So I guess I would pose it as an interesting question. Is it, how is it that a city can do well despite the level of corruption? I'd want to know more about the level of corruption. I would agree with you up to a point. I would also think, too, that the relations, particularly the racial issue, you noted the cynicism and the sense in the black community. And you quoted Washington and the truly disadvantaged, which was the phrase Bill Wilson used in his book, where you had the outmigration of the middle class from the inner city, where you had the ghetto communities that were severely disadvantaged. And, of course, they still do exist. On the other hand, it's a much more complex phenomenon. We now have middle class black suburbs. The poverty problem is no longer a, quote, inner city problem. There's deep poverty now in the suburbs. In fact, nationally, the increases in poverty have been quite high in the suburbs. And if you look at places in the south suburbs, right here in Chicago, you see it. And you also see quite a bit of a change in the housing situation. The Chicago Housing Authority, notorious, of course, with regard to the housing projects that were erected. Some would argue that it was deliberate in terms of the segregation, places like Cabrini Green, places like Robert Taylor Homes. Well, for better or for worse, they're gone now. Robert Taylor Homes was torn down. We now have the plan for transformation. I think the jury's still out. I think there's been some improvement, but where those residents have moved, it's an open question in terms of whether their lives are actually better. So those are the kinds of questions I think we need to pursue and that we're still studying in terms of are they, in fact, better off than they were before. I think we can say that some of the neighborhoods are better off, but yet there's been a shift, again, in places like Englewood are doing perhaps worse than they were because of an influx of very poor residents.
Philip Niden, you've heard me do my Zola-esque j'accuse against the city of Chicago for the very heavy corruption tax that we've paid for years, and I think we're still paying. Indeed, I think it's getting higher and higher as a tax level. What do you say to that?
I think reacting to what you're describing, I think, correctly as pinstripe corruption, and which in many ways I think is the lack of guts to go after some of the causes of issues. If even before our current real estate crisis, there was a serious subprime lending crisis in the low-income African-American community. And some elected officials are going after that, but that wasn't a big issue. There's been a job loss of living wage jobs. There's been poor quality of education in some sectors of Chicago and maybe not as much in others. And the question is, are there elected officials that are going to really carry that and very often challenge some of the bigger forces, which may be banks and their own policies in some cases? And I think this is where – this is sort of this sort of where – community and some of these bigger forces clash. That's community is still extremely important because that's where it plays out. A 65-year-old grandmother who's about to lose her house on the west side of Chicago, that's not merely a Chicago and community issue, but that's probably the banks are probably there's something to do with that. And there's also how much money you have in your pension plan and what you've earned over your life and what your family's been earning. So those are key issues. And I think corruption is a serious issue. Those are folks not representing those elected officials. I think there are lots of very effective elected officials out there. We need more of them. And I think the pressure has to be put on all officials.
Are things getting better or are they just as bad as they were?
I think there's different strategies, is different experiences. As I said, I think there were some changes with Harold Washington. In fact, the quote, that brief conversation clipped, he was talking about making the way the city works, the way you can get zoning changed, the way you can build property, build buildings. One of his points was you can't build a building without greasing someone's palm. You have to change that. That's a dysfunctional city. And actually, his administration in a very short time made some changes there. I think Richard M. Daley made some changes after that, partially building off of that, although one could argue that he also had some good friends who were developers as well.
He did indeed. Robert Sampson.
Yeah, I think I would agree with the pinstripe issue in both of you, actually, although one must remember that a lot of the pernicious consequences of institutional behavior are legal. So in other words, if you think about some of the subprime lending, for example,
I refer to it as sort of legal corruption.
Yeah, but that's not corruption in the technical sense. I mean, if we go back and you talk about, you know, people being on the take and the police officer who gets the free lunch or gets paid off or whatever, you know, that's what people typically think of, or the alderman that gets paid off or the contract stuff. And yes, that exists. But some of these more institutional forces, and you know, a lot has been written on this in terms of, in previous era, redlining, for example, and real estate steering. But in the present day, we've just seen nationally, it's not just in Chicago, Wall Street is quite implicated in all this. And I think what's important is that it's not necessarily corruption. So yes, I totally agree that we want to look at these sorts of things. And yet much of it is technically legal behavior.
Would you get a little nervous about a candidate for the mayoralty who spent 2 years with a financial firm in Chicago and came away with $18 million?
Yeah, I'd be suspicious.
Yeah.
Well, more morally, perhaps.
I see you smile at that, Philip Niden. Why?
I agree. I mean, I think what are the origins of elected officials? Who are they beholden to? Mm-hmm. I think they're I think Dick Simpson would probably agree there's a serious need for campaign finance reform. There's various proposals out there, but you know, who's paying to get people elected and the contract issues? Those are serious issues.
Yet I gather, Robert Sampson, you mentioned the phrase. It comes, I think, from either Time or Newsweek magazine way back a long time ago in an article about Chicago when they labeled it the city that works. And you think Chicago is a city that works as compared to some other major American cities, would you say?
Yeah, I can't think about, you know, the phrase the city that works just alone. One has to compare it to others.
Yeah.
I think it depends. Certainly there are other cities that are much more dysfunctional than Chicago.
Newark?
I would think Newark. I think Detroit. I think there's a long line of cities. I think
they're disassembling Detroit.
Yeah, I mean, talk about corruption. Some serious corruption there. In fact, the mayor there was quite blatant. So everything's relative. And there's cities that I think are more professional. If you take studies of policing, for example, it's long been known that places, let's say like Los Angeles or some of the West Coast cities, are more legalistic in the sense of how they operate, sort of the letter of the law, compared to cities like Chicago or New York, which were traditionally known as order maintenance type police departments, where there was corruption, where the police would let certain behaviors occur in neighborhoods because that was thought to be okay there, as opposed to, again, sort of a more legalistic style. But there's paradoxes there, too. So complaints against the police, for example, skyrocketed in places like Los Angeles because they felt that the police were too intrusive in their lives. And now you see a new regime in New York where stop and frisk, for example, the number of residents on the street that are stopped, went from something like 90,000 to over 500,000 in the last 5 or 6 years. So it's complicated in terms of what sorts of behaviors do we define as most problematic. And Chicago hasn't seen that sort of intervention, to my knowledge, in terms of the way that police operate in terms of interactions with citizens. Although, then again, you go back in terms of some of the torture cases that were just horrific.
In Chicago.
In Chicago, yeah. Absolutely. Former officer serving time, rightfully so, on that.
Do American urban sociologists look at urban centers elsewhere in the world and compare our cities to those? If you look to the cities of Western Europe, or even to our near neighbor Canada, or to Australia, that's the part of the world that we appropriately may compare ourselves to. Those are the cousin countries, so to speak. Do those cities work better than ours?
It depends which ones we're talking about. And
Do some work just as badly as ours?
I think there are, you go to certain European cities, for example, London has had in the past a regional government that has been effective. We've done a lot of work in our center with colleagues in Sydney, Australia, which is an impressive place to visit. And I think there are some progressive aspects of that. If you go north, Toronto has had longstanding sort of stable diversity in many communities, partially with some strong, again, regional government there as well. So I think there's some positive examples. But on the other hand, I think Chicago is a wonderful city. I think we're not saying that at all. In fact, it's almost like it's okay to argue among members of your family, but when you're outside, you tend to defend it. And I, as someone who works in Chicago and has lived in the area for a long time, I think in many ways is a much more livable city than aspects of New York or L.A., let's say, are the two competitors for the top three.
Gentlemen, I've committed not a crime but a great indiscretion. I was supposed to have stopped 10 minutes ago for some commercials, and I'm so wound up in this conversation that I did not meet my duty. Therefore, I'm speaking now to my friends in the booth, most particularly to Aubrey Mumpower. What I propose, Aubrey, with your consent, is that we're going to stop in about 2 minutes for commercials, and then we'll blend that into the next commercial break, which means that the program will be in abeyance for some 6 or 7 minutes, and then we'll come back. Is that workable? It is, I'm told. Therefore, that's what's going to happen, and that's information for all of the listeners. Shortly, we're going to stop for the longest commercial break plus newscast you have ever heard on this program, at least. But before we do, quickly, I said we would talk more about what this book of Robert Sampson's is all about. namely the enduring neighborhood effect. You've said a little bit about that, but not fully, because I didn't give you the opportunity. Let's define it more fully right now. We'll probably come back to it after that very lengthy commercial break to come.
Sure. So what I do in the book is to look at the influence of neighborhoods on behavior, the behavior of individuals, and how the city is socially organized spatially. As I noted, I think, before, I show that there's a great deal of concentration across a wide variety of behaviors in neighborhoods, a surprisingly diverse array of phenomena, again, going from health to crime to aspects even of civic life. So, for example, take civic participation or even protest events. They are concentrated in place. They are persistent over time. This concentration, this persistence, I think helps us understand that neighborhoods, unlike the a lot of common wisdom, are powerful. The narrative today is that the world has changed. There's globalization. We have increased technology. The world is thought to be flat. That leads us to a sense that, well, we can be anywhere, so therefore the particulars of our individual places must not be that important. And another argument is that it's really the characteristics of the individuals in the family, sort of the individual personality, the family characteristics, and that that's what really matters, not your surroundings. I challenge that and argue that despite these individual characteristics, the neighborhoods really do matter. And in fact, I show that the neighborhoods influence those very characteristics.
And you've got data collected over the years, and we're going to look at some of that data. When we return, I say now again to our listeners, hang in there, be patient. This will be a long break, but we shall return to Robert Sampson and to Philip Niden, and later to you on the phones at 312-591-7200. Right now, we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we are back to Philip Niden and to Robert Sampson. We were talking about the enduring neighborhood effect, which is the focus of the new book by Robert Sampson, the full title, Great American City, Chicago, and the Enduring Neighborhood Effect. But I gather the neighborhood effect is not particular to Chicago.
No, and I think going back to your point about cities around the world, I think the comparative study of cities and of neighborhoods is incredibly important. It wasn't the main focus of the book, but nonetheless, we were able to undertake a replication of a key portion of what was known as the community study. What we did is to interview almost about 8,000 residents of Chicago and ask them detailed questions about their interactions, their perceptions of the neighborhood. And I had a colleague from Stockholm, Sweden at the time, and we struck up a collaboration, and through a stroke of luck, we're able to mount a survey that was carried out in Stockholm, several thousand residents there, and really directly compare some of the key arguments of the book. And I think some of the findings are pretty interesting. One, the data show that the relationship between concentration of disadvantage and violence is very similar in terms of the increasing rate of disadvantage leading to an increasing rate of violence and then tailing off. But there are distinct differences between the two cities. Number one, Chicago has a large number of neighborhoods that are severely disadvantaged that Stockholm simply does not. But it also has a lot of neighborhoods that are very affluent, which Stockholm does not. So what you really see is the compression effect, or in other words, the inequality that exists in American society is manifested at the level of neighborhoods. And secondly, the mechanisms or the social processes that are related to violence seem to be similar, even though Chicago is more violent, even though it has more inequality. Specifically, the relationship between what we called collective efficacy and violence was quite similar. Collective efficacy is really about neighborhoods where people trust one another and they have a shared expectation that others will take action. So, for example, if the library or the local community needs something or kids are, let's say, outside skipping school, where there is a more expectation that neighbors will do something, violence is lower. And that relationship is quite similar in the two cities. So you see similarities and you see differences. There are now studies underway in Los Angeles, Australia, London, England, Miami. So it's both around the United States and other cities around the world. So in this global era, I think this is a very exciting turn.
But we do find a general correlation between degree of deprivation in the community.
Yeah, even though the form of deprivation is different, because in Swedish society, we don't have the same, I mean, race doesn't have the same meaning. There, the disadvantaged groups are immigrant groups,
deprivation,
right?
Deprivation and criminal behavior are correlated.
Correct. The concentration of deprivation there, it's immigrants from Morocco Turkey. And Turkey, whereas in the United States, it tends to be African Americans.
In Chicago, what do we know? What are the data tell us about the number of black arrests and black prosecutions? Do they lead all other groups?
I would defer to my colleague.
Well, it depends. I understand they do.
Yeah, it depends what type of crime. And the patterns aren't always what we think. I mean, if you go to things like drug use, particularly at an early age, there aren't any race differences very much. If anything, the
black drug peddlers sell it to the suburban white.
Well, the drug use, actually white use is higher.
Yeah.
And then at a later age, it tends to shift a bit. For violence, things like robbery and homicide, there tends to be a higher rate of arrest for African-Americans compared to whites. That's correct. So it depends on the type of crime.
And heavier prosecution and more common incarceration.
Incarceration rates are very different. And I show in particular that the incarceration rates are really a difference of kind, not just degree. It's quite striking, actually. If you take the community in Chicago, East Garfield Park, I believe it is, it has the highest rate of incarceration in the black community. And you compare that to the community in Chicago that has the highest rate of incarceration in a predominantly white community. Mm-hmm. So in other words, the highest white incarcerated community, yeah. If we can put it that way, and then the highest incarcerated black community, it's 42 times higher for the black community. 42.
Times.
Now, if we get differences of two or three times in social science, that's a lot. So
probably non-overlapping distributions.
They're non-overlapping distributions, yeah. And that's one of the real pernicious realities of concentration of disadvantage, in that there really aren't very many comparison cases. That is, we do not see white kids growing up in the kinds of communities that many black children grow up in. We don't even have that comparison. So a lot of the statistical studies are actually making phantom comparisons. There's a technical story behind that that listeners probably don't want to hear, but it's substantively and conceptually, it's a very important
point.
So
in the great question and the phrasing given us by Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, no less, what is to be done?
Well, that's a $64,000 question.
I mean, one of the issues on, given the high proportion of incarcerations, and especially in among African-American males, what's the figure? About a third of all African-American males have been in prison at one point.
That's correct.
But is a prisoner a reentry issue? Is when people leave prison, how do they get reentered into communities in a constructive way? And this is an issue that's popping up more and more in the past 2 or 3 years among many of the community partners we work with. Our center is somewhat distinct because we really only do research with community partners at the table. So try to get a sense of what the immediate needs are. But I think this is a serious new issue. And apropos to looking at how you strengthen community, this is a critical issue facing this city and many others.
I think that's correct. Although I would also point to what I call in the book, the need to look at pre-entry. That is to say, we need to go earlier in the life course, and the kinds of disadvantages that build up over time tend to occur relatively early in the life course. So I think intervening to help children and families, particularly in disadvantaged environments, is really crucial. And I think a lot of the science is coming around to this view now. And if you think about learning, it's not just violence that doesn't occur till much later in life, but cognitive deficits, learning patterns, exposure to violence, we're now learning is a fundamental feature of how kids perceive the world, and those that are exposed to high rates of violence at an early age are more likely to commit violence later. They're more likely to have trouble learning. Research is really coming around, I think, to a consensus on this. So I think that that tells us that we need to think about holistic interventions at the level of communities and in education as well.
Gentlemen, with that, we're about to pause for another group of commercials. But before that, it is time to invite telephone calls. We propose to go to the phones directly after the impending commercials. So the lines are open, and we look forward to your calls. We're talking about the city we all live in, though, of course, lots of our listeners are not in Chicago. Lots of our listeners, in fact, are former Chicagoans listening on the West Coast or listening, for that matter, in Beijing, where we've had a few calls, a few emails from Chicagoans. 312-591-7200, not merely for questions, but for any thoughts you've got, any experiences or facts you want to put before us relating to Chicago's glories and its degradation. 312-591-7200. The lines are open, and we look forward to your calls. Get them in instantly if you want to be heard. And again, for email, the email address, wherever you are in the world or in the country, is extension 720 at WGNradio.com. And we'll be directly back to your queries, your comments after this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we will go directly to the phones. Our guests, Philip Niden, professor of sociology at Loyola, and Robert Sampson, professor of the same discipline, both of them urban sociologists, and Robert Sampson at Harvard University. 312-591-7200 for anything you want to say or ask. And I put an emphasis on say. Your opinions, your experiences, your report of life in Chicago is as interested, as relevant as direct questions you want to ask. And we go now to the first caller, that one being Ali. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, Mr. Rosenberg. It's a pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you.
Sir, I'm 32 years old. I live in Schaumburg now. I grew up in the north side of Chicago. Really quickly, I just want to tell you, I got into trouble as a teenager, 16 and 17. And you know, I grew out of that phase as I got older. You know, I joined the military also. But it was really difficult for me to even join the military. And when I came out of there, in order to get employment, I was always held back by, you know, this is talking about integration back into society. If you commit a crime and when you come back, you're really, your choices are very narrowed. You really can't get into a lot of fields. You're limited. And, you know, if there's, you know, if they can help these kids that get in trouble, help them integrate back into society by helping them either expunge their records or find them employment or find them new avenues, I think that's going to be the key to get a lot of these kids help that they need. Because I've struggled for 10 years since what happened to me, you know, or for my mistakes.
What were you actually arrested and for?
There was a couple of things. Like when I was young, I got arrested for shoplifting, and then it was a misdemeanor. But then my second offense, you know, it was back to back because I was a bad kid. You know, growing up in the city, I was just an average kid. One was trespassing. It was involving, you know, broke into a car, but it was all misdemeanor. The charges were brought down to just misdemeanor, but they follow me till this day. Yep. And you know, anytime I want to do something in life, that holds me back. From employment, from interviews, you know, just to move ahead in life. I have two kids of my own now. I'm a grown adult. I work for a Fortune 500 company, but I can't move up in the company because of my background.
Yeah, we do understand, and that's very, very significant. Let's get some response. And first from Robert Sampson.
Yes, unfortunately, Ali's experience is rather common and is borne out in research, which shows that the stigma of a criminal record carries with people for relatively long periods of time. And it's not just employment, but any number of things. So I think it goes to the point I was making earlier about the need to try to stem these sorts of behaviors and problems, hopefully before they occur. Because once arrested or once incarcerated, it's hard to erase that. There really are legacies to these kinds of criminal justice interventions that we need to think very carefully about. And it's multiplied when you have communities where a high proportion of the population is incarcerated, or you might even think of it, particularly in some of the communities of Chicago, they're almost like incarcerated communities.
I certainly think if you have communities that have more opportunities, less inequity, the Swedish example you were giving, I think if there are jobs out there, and many more of them than we currently have available, then there's less issues of restricting the job market. There'll be more opportunities, I think.
Sir, we thank you for the call, and I'm sorry we can't give any great encouragement. Do they handle these things better in other places? If you want to do a Swedish comparison,
well,
how does that work there?
Yeah, well, Sweden, the rate of arrest and incarceration is just so much lower.
Yeah.
Yes. That's really that's the fundamental difference right there.
We go back to the phones, 312-591-7200. And next up is Rob. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
You know, I'm a Chicago cop, 20 years almost. I just astounded on how when I first came on and how I feel now. And I've worked the West Side, South Side. These kids get hooked up with these narcotic offenses, very minute. State's attorney's office being, you know, what they are, plead a kid down from a Class X down to a regular felony, no matter what the grade felony might be, a Class 4 is the least. But he's a convicted felon because he doesn't want to go to the joint. And then years later, when he tries to turn his life around like that previous caller, it's like a tattoo on your forehead you just can't get rid of. And then the kid just sees that he can't do too much, so he goes back to the way of gang life. And the problem that I see in Chicago, and Gary McCarthy, our superintendent, is seeing, you have 40-plus years of this going on of entrenchment in gangs as a way of life. And my point is, this can't keep going on forever. And how many jails are we going to build? And I'll get off the phone and listen.
No,
to
stay on the phone.
Okay.
This is
all
very
right.
Good point you're making. Let's get some response.
You know, I think this is a really critical issue, and it's this issue of producing opportunity, and gangs, and unfortunately, can produce one bit of upward mobility in some communities, and that's part of some community infrastructure. I think it's short-circuiting that, and that's I'll leave it up to the criminologists who should have more answers, right?
Well, there's no simple answer, unfortunately, but. What you're pointing out is a crucial issue, and I would view it within the context of the vicious cycle that occurs with regard to involvement, not just in the criminal justice system, but often in crime and in gang life, which then leads to a spiraling effect. And you see this. So you see it within individual lives, and again, you see it within neighborhoods, the notion of sort of the poverty traps that these communities get involved in. And it's very hard for the communities to turn around, and it's hard for the individuals. And that's why, again, I hearken back to the notion that we really, in order to make a dent in the problem in the long run, we have to start intervening early. And I will say, however, somewhat of an optimist that I am, there are some positive signs on the horizon. Let's bear in mind that the violence rate in Chicago, as in other cities, as in the United States, is down. It's down a lot. We're now back to levels that we haven't seen since the 1950s. We saw a great deal of increase in crime in the 1960s, and then another spike in the late 80s and into the 90s, and homicide was incredibly high. Actually, when we started our study, it was just after the peak rate of violence in Chicago's history. And now we're seeing a tremendous improvement. So I think that needs to be on the table as well, that there are some things that are going right. I'm not sure it has to do with any intervention, because every city pretty much is seeing this, so it's hard to attribute it to a particular police policy. But there are some positive signs on the horizon.
Would you maybe say that it's because of the – there's two things that I've seen just on the street is – generations of black males being wiped out with violence, with the gangs and stuff, and then the longer incarceration offenses by the feds, which I'm seeing more and more, where the feds are getting involved, where, say, maybe county would have gave them 3 years, and or the state, and they're out within 18 months. Feds are putting these guys away for, I mean, lifetimes now, and that's another thing that might be a reason why a lot of it's down, too. As I mean, you got a generation wiped out with violence, which you do in Inglewood and on the West Side, and you have long stretches of what they call those lockdowns of 23 and a half hours a day. They're locked up in some supermax somewhere.
Well, it's true that incapacitation, when someone's taken off the street, they can't commit a crime. The research on this shows, though, that the increase in the imprisonment rate accounts for approximately 15 to 20%. That's the consensus estimate of the decline in violence or the decline in crime. So there's a lot more going on than incarceration that explains what's happening. There's actually, a thesis out there in terms of cultural change even.
A question to the caller. We're short on time, sir, but if you can give me this in a brief minute, I'd appreciate it. What do you, as a veteran policeman, make of the rather startling increase in murder in this town over the last few months?
Oh, I could totally tell you what it is. I have a theory. The feds have taken out a lot of the gang leadership and put them in supermax. They can no longer control what we call the shorties. There used to be a lot of respect amongst the ranks where, I'm just using vernacular, if that was Junebug's corner, out of respect for his mama and his grandpapa, they wouldn't do anything. Now it's, well, he's locked up. He ain't getting out anyway. Blam, blam, blam. Quick buck, the quick turnaround, no respect for themselves. And that's a generation, two generations now of gangs in the city, and I just don't see it stopping. I just don't see that one superintendent within a year. I think Superintendent McCarthy is starting to see, wow, this is really a big problem.
That is fascinating. Thank you very much for the call.
Oh, sure. Thanks for taking my call.
And we go to the WGN Newsroom and David Jennings.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we now have a few lines available again. If you've been trying to reach us and not getting through, but getting the busy signal, do try again. One or two people will get through if they move quickly at 312-591-7200. And, of course, the email is of infinite capacity. You can get there by just going to extension 720 at WGN Radio. And for phones, again, 312-591-7200. And on the phone, we're joined by Helen. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening. How are you, Mr. Rosenberg?
Just fine.
I have a simple question. Maybe I missed it, but the crime rate in Chicago, you have stated, has been going down, and that's a good thing.
But the murder rate has been going up.
Right, unfortunately. I mean, every time you turn on the news, it's two or three a day. It seems it's ridiculous. But has anyone taken a look at the suburbs and the crime rates? Because a lot of people are moving away from the city, of course, because of the violence and because of, various crimes. But has anyone taken a look at the increase of crime in the suburbs? Now, I'm in the far west suburbs. I'm in the Downers Grove area. And it just seems like, the crime rates have been going up steadily, maybe not quite as obviously as a, big metropolitan area.
Yeah. I should tell you, Robert Sampson is the president-elect of what, the American Criminological?
American Society of Criminology.
Of Criminology. You should know the answer to this question.
Well, I don't know for Chicago specifically in terms of, recent, let's say the last year, into the suburbs. As I noted earlier, it is true that we've seen an increase in the suburbanization of poverty. And so we know that the concentration of poverty is related to crime. So it's a logical step to think that the crime rate has increased. I haven't studied the suburbs in Chicago again in recent years. And in terms of this recent increase, I think we have to be careful because in any year or even in a month, there can be spurts of violence. We really have to wait to know whether this is a real increase or not. I'm looking at it from the perspective of several years or even over the last decade and comparing it to the peak rates of violence. So, again, the facts are that the violence rate is down. The last few months, I still follow the news. I still, I was walking the streets of Chicago today. Every time I'm here, I try to keep a sense of what's going on in the city. And it does seem like it's in the news and there's a lot happening. And my sense is that, particularly in the south suburbs, there is, again, has been an increase in poverty, and I've heard complaints about not just violence, but it seems that there's also some of the concern among mayors about having to deal with housing problems.
Right.
and so forth. So this needs to be looked at. And in fact, I think that over the years, the suburban face of America with regard to social problems has really been overlooked. And partly that's because, you know, the notion of suburbs is sort of, you know, white picket fences and, you know, it's idyllic. But in fact, many, many social problems exist in suburbs, and it seems to be getting worse. So social scientists are now turning their attention to it.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Philip Knighton.
Well, certainly also just in sheer absolute numbers, we have a metropolitan area of 8 million people, fewer than 3 million in the city of Chicago, so that leaves 5 million people living outside. So just by sheer numbers, there'll be more crimes committed outside. Also, there's been shifts of jobs to the suburbs. So there's all, again, the city-suburb distinction is not always as useful, and not only here but other cities as well. And there's quite a diversity of suburbs. There's a lot of suburbs that are in big financial trouble. The communities there just aren't jobs. So,
And it always does seem to be the focus is Cook County because of the vast number of people living in the area. But when you start drifting out into the old sleepy villages, the DuPage area. You start seeing these crime rates and everything going up. It's ridiculous. I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, I've been in the area for 40 plus years, and it's just astonishing to see, what's happening in these little areas you drive through.
Yes, supposedly overall we have a crisis at the national level. There's a decrease in crime rates.
That's correct.
How does that account?
What accounts for it?
Yeah.
Well, people are arguing about this. There's many different competing explanations. One has already been noted, that the incarceration rate is behind it. Yeah. Some argue that more efficient policing procedures are behind it. Others argue that it's a change in the composition of the population. One thesis argues that, in fact, the increase in immigration in the last 10 or 15 years, the great spike from immigration around the world has actually led to a decrease in crime. I've actually been part of that argument. It's a bit counterintuitive, but that's another thesis. Yeah. So there's really four or five sort of suspects in terms of the great crime drop.
Ma'am, we thank you for the call, and we go quickly to the next, that being Mike. You're on the air, sir.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Dr. Rosenberg.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask your guests, what do they think of Chicago's attempt to institutionalize its corruption? The state has a website that tracks political contributions from individuals, and they have to list their employer. Now, the last mayor stated he was no longer going to take contributions from companies that did business with the city, but he continued to take contributions from officers of those same companies. Now, it seems like they're splitting hairs. But if you talk to any Democrat in Chicago, they'll say that even people that make millions of dollars off of rigged contracts have a right to contribute.
What do you mean by a rigged contract? I've never heard a contract being rigged.
Well,
what is that?
The way some contracts, and I work for the city, the way they're written up is they're written where everybody bids at a certain price, and then the expensive requirements of the contract, the parts that drive up the costs, are not enforced. A company that the city wants to get the contract will underbid everybody, knowing they won't have to fulfill the whole contract. A case in point would be the bus shelters. One of the requirements of the bus shelters when they were installed was that they had to be illuminated, and the contractor would have to pick up the electrical feed from Commonwealth Edison. Well, everybody bid at a high price except for one company that knew that once they got the contract, the city relaxed the requirement and said, if it's easier and cheaper for you, just pick it up from the streetlight feed. And the company knew it wouldn't be that expensive, but they underbid everybody, but the city paid the higher rate.
You say you work for the city. Can you tell
us,
without identifying yourself, can you tell us in what capacity?
I'm a construction laborer with the Division of Electrical Operations.
Uh-huh.
And every contract the city's gone out for street lights or traffic lights in the last 5 or 6 years has been rigged. And the problem is, over 25% of the present city budget are private contracts, and that keeps going up year in year.
Now, Stay in there for a second. This is very interesting to me, and you're confirming what I was saying before. Gentlemen, do you count this as pinstripe corruption, which is, quote, legal corruption, or is it, in fact, criminal?
Not being a lawyer, I couldn't tell you exactly, but it seems to be on the edge.
It seems a little bit of both. And it's not just pinstripe. It sounds like it goes right down to almost a blue collar. And to the extent that this is pervasive, I think it, again, leads to a certain sense among citizens of
business as usual. This is pure Chicago. Have you ever tried to report this to legitimate authorities there?
Yes. A couple reporters are looking into it now. The FBI seems disinterested. I've talked to them a few times in person, and their eyes glaze over. The FBI doesn't have a problem going after a black or Hispanic city inspector that takes a couple hundred hours. They'll have the room wired for sound and video. But if you talk about millions of dollars in rigged contracts, you know, it seems like, you know, you've got the Daily and the Obama, the Daily and the Emanuel friend in the White House. Nothing's going to happen to them.
Would you come on this program if we covered, if we did not disclose your identity?
I don't care if you disclose my identity or not. I can send you copies of engineering reports if you wish.
Would you hold on while I ask my producer to take your name and phone number?
Sure.
All right. How do I do that, gentlemen? They're doing it right now. Very good. And we have to pause for a quick round of commercials.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to the phones. Again, some lines available if you want to get in there. Move quickly. You will get through. Somebody will get through. 312-591-7200. And here's another mic. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen. I just had a quick question going back to the crime in Chicago and other areas. Has any research shown where areas where firearms are allowed to be carried by, you know, citizens, a concealed carry permit or anything like that issued, has crime and violence tend to trend down, or does it stay around the same?
Well, John Lott, who's done the major research on this, though he's very passionately partisan, says that concealed carry tends to produce reduction in crime. Does that verify with you, gentlemen?
Yes. Yeah, so this is an area of vigorous research, and and a lot of controversy. Professor Rosenberg is absolutely right that Lott has argued that if you're carrying a weapon, you're more likely to use it if attacked, and therefore there's kind of this deterrent effect. That position, in turn, has been challenged. Researchers such as Phil Cook at Duke University, among others, have argued that it's not the case.
Okay, well, I know that I live in Indiana, and I do have a permit to carry, which I do carry probably about 95% of the time. And as a member of society that does carry, I do know that if I'm in a convenience store and somebody comes in and robs it and no one's in immediate danger, I'm going to do everything in my power to walk away and not confront the person. Whereas if my family is getting into a vehicle and somebody comes up with, you know, a weapon, then Indiana is no longer a retreat state, so I can stand my ground. And I was just wondering, you know, I personally don't like traveling to Illinois because it's one of the few states that I can't have a weapon with me just in case. And do you see Illinois anytime soon allowing any type of carry? They're one of two states left in the country that don't allow it.
I don't see it anytime soon.
Okay.
And again, even though there's controversy, my own reading of the evidence suggests that the there is not much of a deterrent effect from what I can see. And, you know, more guns in high violence communities, it doesn't seem that that's a good recipe for dealing with the problem, and partly because people aren't all that good at judging what the motives and intentions of others are. We've seen recent episodes of that. But on an everyday basis, what we do know is that in terms of encounters on the street, sometimes, you know, insults or somebody says something about one's girlfriends or what they're wearing, and then there's fights and stabbings and shootings. Because people feel threatened or feel insulted. And when you involve drugs and alcohol in that mix, it's quite an explosive situation. So there's a lot of research that suggests that in that case, guns are not necessarily going to help the situation.
Well, we have a very moving and troubling case right now in Florida, of course, that Zimmerman
right
thing.
Yeah, and in that case, weapons clearly are at front and center about that. But it also points out some of the key themes that we were talking about earlier in terms of neighborhood and the intersection of places and race. I mean, the sense of what is appropriate behavior in a community, what is disorder. Our research shows that the perceptions of disorder are heavily driven by aspects such as the racial composition of people in public. And so, unfortunately, that was not surprising to me. There's a deep connection in American society between the kinds of assumptions that all citizens, by the way, tend to make. This is not just a racial statement about prejudice, let's say, on the part of whites or blacks. In our data, whites, blacks, Asians, others, all groups tend to perceive there to be more disorder when there's a greater concentration of minority groups. So it's a sort of this pernicious, vicious cycle that has unfortunate consequences.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir, for the call. And we'll go directly to the next, that being Vic. Good evening, sir.
Hi, how are you, Milt?
All right.
Being a neighborhood guy for over 50 years, first of all, I don't buy all the statistics that people give. Personally, even in the last 4 months, I made a couple police calls. They were not recorded. So crime is being underreported. And if you think that the federal government is doing the right job on keeping statistics, we know by prior things that everybody's playing with statistics. So I totally believe that the crime is up all over. It is spreading to the burbs now. I've been in 7 community organizations. One of the problems today is you can't get the young people into them, unless it's particularly concerning their school or anything. And the old people that form these organizations are dying off. Now, I've been through neighborhoods. When Lincoln Park was started, I could not get a mortgage in 1970 at Armitage and Halsted. And I also went through periods where I stood with a gun and a German Shepherd. So I think another problem is we have transurbans. They're not staying. People passing through. My child's going to be 4 years old. I'm getting out. The last 6 months, I talked to 4 or 5 of my middle-class black friends from the South Side. They're leaving. And you could see the federal government said that 200,000 blacks have left. A lot of middle-class blacks are leaving. Crime is a factor. Gangs are a factor. Commitment to the community is down. It's not the same.
Well, you've said many things. Therefore, what generalization does that lead you to?
I think that the big cities in America are in trouble. That's the generalization.
Uh-huh. Well, that's an interesting point. Gentlemen.
Well, there's lots of issues there. I think it's a matter of how well communities have organized. It's just getting to the point we were talking about earlier. We had an incident in my own neighborhood a few years ago, and someone threw a brick through our neighbor's window. What was one real indicator to me of how tight our neighborhood was, within 30 seconds there have been 4 calls to 911, and there were 25 neighbors on the street within 60 seconds. To me, I feel very comfortable and safe in that kind of neighborhood, and I think this is exactly one of these points. How do you create...
What neighborhood is that?
This was in Evanston, and this was a very diverse neighborhood in many ways, and... But I think it's knowing there are folks looking out for you and you're looking out for other folks. Mm-hmm. And this is not lost. It's still there. It's very much there in neighborhoods. And I think there's lots of organizations and lots of community leaders that are pushing this forward.
I'd have to agree with Professor Nyden in pointing out the importance of these social factors. What we call the collective efficacy of residents, I think, is what you're talking about. Also, the organizations in the community-based organizations and nonprofits. So there are ways to counteract community decline and crime. On the specifics of what Vic is talking about, with all due respect, I'd have to disagree. I think that we should be suspicious of statistics, but there are ways to get around some of the problems that were noted. For one thing, we can look at the kinds of crimes that are really not error-prone. So, for example, homicide statistics or admissions to hospitals violent injuries, the body counts for, in terms of the coroner's report. We have a pretty good handle on that, and there's really a consensus that the rate of violence, again, in the longer sweep of things in the past 10 or 15 years, is down. Secondly, there is a wide-ranging program whereby citizens themselves are asked about their experience with crime. It has nothing to do with the police, has nothing to do with the federal government, really. It's victimization reports, people telling us whether they've been robbed or not. And the victimization statistics, from what residents tell us, also track these other kinds of statistics and show a downward trend for the most part. So, again, hate to disagree, but on an optimistic note, I do not think that cities overall are on the decline. I think the message is that there's differences across cities. Some cities are in big trouble, but other cities are doing quite fine. In fact, we're increasingly becoming an urban world, and in terms of innovation, in terms of jobs, in terms of the demand where people want to live, the kinds of things that cities offer are, if anything, on the increase. And so while we're seeing increasing globalization, we're also seeing an increasing concentration in some of the key world cities.
Our thanks to the caller. We're virtually out of time. I have for you a last quotation. You remember Charles Edward Merriam? Went around for the mayoralty of Chicago.
He was a political scientist.
From the University of Chicago.
University of Chicago, correct.
And he said many years ago, Chicago is unique. It is the only completely corrupt city in America. Was he overstating the case then, or does that still apply?
Well, I think, it goes to the identity of the city. That's what he was identifying. And as I said, that's persistent, too. There's a durable cultural theme of corruption in Chicago. Just as there's an enduring neighborhood effect, there's an enduring cultural theme of corruption.
Well, we end with yet another University of Chicago voice, then.
That's great.
Charles Edward Merriam. And we end with great thanks to Robert Sampson and Philip Niden for having joined us. We'll be here probably not tomorrow night because of the special playoff hockey game, but back on Tuesday for a one-hour program. Wednesday, we're organizing something which should be quite fascinating, a program on Niccolo Machiavelli and the Machiavellians and Machiavellianism as a major style, technique, philosophy for how to organize polities and keep them essentially more or less functional, and how to keep and use power. We'll talk about all of that on Wednesday night. Until then, well, until Tuesday for a short program, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.